Back together again, you and I chatting in a Monday style, July 14th, 2025 on Connecticut Today. I kicked off another week of the programs talking about mounting pressure on Governor Ned Lamont by some of his own fellow Democrats to raise taxes on the state's wealthiest individuals. Greenwich Republican State Senate member Ryan Fazio dropped by to discuss a controversial move regarding a build-out of EV charging infrastructure around the state. Will it cost people more on their bills? University of New Haven criminal justice lecturer and former supervisory Secret Service agent Bobby McDonald reacted to a new report regarding errors made by the Secret Service connected to an assassination attempt targeting Donald Trump last year. And CBS News reporter Olivia Rinaldi discussed President Trump's announcement of proposed tougher sanctions on Russia.
So make no mistake about it. I'm telling you this. I've been telling you this for weeks, even a couple of months, and this is all falling into place. Make no mistake about this. There is a concerted effort underway. Now, it's always kind of been there, but if you look closely, you can see the elements of it moving in synchronicity with each other. There is a concerted effort now, even more than before, an effort from the left wing of the Democratic Party here in Connecticut to kneecap Governor Ned Lamont. They want to politically whack him as he maybe runs for a third term. More and more of the stuff you're seeing now is indicative of that, and they are intent on taking a big step in doing this with a special session coming up on housing. Even though Governor Ned Lamont, depending upon what poll you look at, has an overall approval rate of somewhere between about 52 or 53% and 62 or 63%. It's probably in the middle. It's probably in the mid to upper 50s in a blue state, while giving labor and giving the far left a lot, but not all of what it wants. No matter that standing, the lefties in this state are not happy. And now they're openly talking about it and openly talking about something I had warned you about. And I've been saying this for a couple of 3 weeks now, kids. And if you've listened to me, you know I've been telling you this. The liberal wing of the Democratic Party, because there are some Democratic centrists in the state, not too many. I mean, you can count them on one hand and still have enough fingers to scratch an itch, as they say, as a buddy of mine used to say. But the far left of the Democratic Party in Hartford, some vocally, some not so vocally, they see this upcoming special session in Hartford, which I guess is going to happen in September, soon as everybody's back from their vacations, soon as school is back in session and everybody can settle in. They've got a couple of weeks out there where they are licking their chops. You may say, well, why? It's only a housing bill. No, 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 no. They're starting to talk about, guess what? Higher taxes. The left in this state, the Democratic majority left in Hartford, they have a maniacal, oozing, dripping desire to raise your taxes, because they want more money. The fact that this state, largely at the behest of Republican legislators back in 2016, 2017 or so, put in these guardrails to hold the line on spending, the Democrats in Hartford have no idea what to do with themselves. They are apoplectic at this. They are apoplectic that Ned Lamont vetoed a housing bill that, okay, maybe he favored, and then in the end he heard from a lot of first select men and women, a lot of town leaders and mayors, and said, yeah, let's start over on this. That's his prerogative. That drives the left wing of the Democratic Party in Hartford, many of whom have been there for 10, 15, 20, 30 years, many of whom are fossils in Hartford. It drives the fossils crazy. You know what else drives them crazy is that Governor Ned Lamont would not sign a preposterous, asinine bill to kiss the asses of organized labor to pay somebody that goes on strike. In what universe does that make sense? And the governor said that. He goes, listen, that's a bridge too far. I've come through for organized labor, he said numerous times, and he has. Paying people if they're on strike is asinine. My words, not his. So a lot of the Democrats in Hartford are apoplectic now. They're acting like children, and now they've basically gone on record to say, hey, they have not given up, and watch out. I've been telling you this. Watch out for that special session coming up, because they are going to try and kneecap the governor. If this was the Sopranos of Connecticut politics, they've made the phone call to Big Pussy, Johnny Sack, and Paulie Walnuts. They want something done. And they're saying it. What do you mean they're saying it? I'll explain coming up. So let me ask you this question, because this is something that is being proposed. It was proposed, and Governor Ned Lamont said, no, we're not going to do this. And the left wing of his party is still maniacally crazed about it. You have the Senate Democratic leader, Martin Looney, Senate leader pro tem, Bob Duff is the Democratic leader in the Senate. And you have Mr. Looney in an op-ed in the CT Insider. You may have seen this a couple of days ago. He, again, is recycling the old, tedious, clown-like push to raise taxes on the richest here in Connecticut. And you see, this is why the left wing of the Democratic Party cannot stand Ned Lamont. And this is bad news. Because if you like Ned Lamont and you say, hey, I don't think a Republican can win, the guy's not all that bad, well, I got to tell you, you better pray if a Republican doesn't win, then Ned Lamont wins. Because all the other alternatives are going to raise your taxes. Here's an op-ed. You may have seen this. Martin Looney, Senate leader. He's been there, I think, 32, 33 years. The state of Connecticut could provide more property tax relief if it had more resources. So what he's saying here, listen to this. So the new tack now from the far left of the Democratic Party, and the reason I say the far left is, yeah, this is from the far left of the party, the part of the party that just wants to raise your taxes and spend money. Tax and spend, tax and spend, tax and spend, tax and spend. Looney writes, quoting him in part, more property tax equity in Connecticut could be a... By the way, you know what equity is? Taking what you have and giving it to somebody else. That's when you hear equity, that means somebody gets something else because you have more than them. So be careful when you hear the word equity. Equity is a decision made by somebody who's not involved in the process to say you will get more or you will have less, and it's coming out of you, you, and you. More property tax equity in Connecticut could be accomplished with, get this now, and we talked about this, and it didn't go anywhere, and half of the Democrats are going nuts over it. A 1.75% surcharge endorsed by the General Assembly's Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee this year on capital gains income, generally the sale of stocks and bonds, aimed at, and Martin Looney comes out and says it here, aimed at the 16,000 richest residents in Connecticut. So this is where the modern-day Democratic Party is in the state. This is how sad and sorry Democrats are in Hartford. They scream and yell when their own governor says, no, we're going to relatively be careful how we spend money. You can't have anything you want. Well, you know, Trump is cutting funding. Yeah, he is. Too bad. Deal with it. So one of the main Senate Democratic leaders, who is among the people, I think, my personal opinion, that's trying to kneecap Ned Lamont, is saying, hey, let's raise a tax that's only going to affect about 16,000 folks in Connecticut. And Marty's run the numbers here, and he says, well, that'll raise about $280 million a year, and here's the rub now. This is the rough. Well, we'll give it to cities and towns for critically needed education aid to cover special ed costs and to increase state payments in lieu of taxes, blah, 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 blah. And let me ask you something. Marty and Bob Duff and Jason Rojas and Matt Ritter, maybe, when that $280 million runs out, what's next? Because you know they're always going to want more. more taxes and more spending. And the head, the titular leader of their own party says, no, we're not going to do that the way we've been doing it. And it drives them crazy, and they are going to kneecap or try to kneecap Ned Lamont. This is how bereft the Connecticut Democratic Party is of new, fresh ideas to move the state forward. A tax aim, they say, and they come out and say it. Martin Looney comes out and says it here. I'm reading it right here from an op-ed of the Connecticut Insider. More property tax equity in Connecticut could be accomplished with a 1.75% surcharge endorsed by the General Assembly on capital gains income, generally the sale of stocks and bonds of the top 16,000 richest residents in Connecticut. Every one of those 16,000 people should give a middle finger to this idea. So we should have 32,000 middle fingers going blank you to the General Assembly. The heck you're going to run the state on our backs? Because that's what that's the suggestion here. They're throwing a tantrum. They're acting like children. Children. Because Ned Lamont said, no, I'm not doing this housing bill that I agreed to, but we'll do it over again. No, I'm not going to pay people who knowingly go out on strike of their own accord money. And no, I'm not going to spend and tax to the level you want me to. But there is no fresh, critical, innovative thinking by the General Assembly's Democratic majority. There just isn't. They've been taking aim at people largely in Fairfield County for years and years and years, and we get the old trope, oh, we need more money on education. Do you know how much Connecticut spent? Connecticut, I think I saw a figure the other day, are the number 4 or number 5 state in the country on education spending. It's around $25,000 a student per year. Money is not the problem. Our test scores suck in the major cities, and they've been sucking for decades. Has money fixed anything? But no, it's the same old tired, lame trope, infuriated by the fact that we have a governor who's at least trying, not successful all the time, but at least trying to keep the fiscal house in order. So that's part one of the example here. So let me ask you this. Before we go to the phones, and Rich and Fairfield, hang on. I'm going to open it up, and I've had this question up on the Facebook page, facebook.com/voiceofct. Should the 16,000 richest Connecticut residents pay more in capital gains tax to help out the rest of the state? Yes or no? What do you think? Should the 16,000, that's how many people would largely be affected by this, so says Marty Looney in the Senate there, 16,000 people. So they say if they can pass this, the 16,000 richest folks in the state going to be forced to fork over about $280 million. That's the great idea from the General Assembly. Tax people more. That's really innovative. Yeah, we've never tried that before in this state. Rich in Fairfield leads us off. Rich, how are you?
I wanted to go off topic to another topic in a second, but your commentary was just so right on what you were just talking about the last few minutes. If you look at federal tax returns, the richest 1% of all the people in the country, you know the stat, they pay 41% of the taxes. So why don't we let them pay more than their fair share? They already pay more than their fair share. This bicameral legislature up there has been Democrat for too long, and this is what you get. It's like inbreeding with the royal families in Europe. You keep inbreeding like this, you're going to get all this moronic stuff. Paul, I want to revisit one thing that's been ongoing.
Yeah.
It has to do with motor vehicles and the bad drivers
and
licenses that are covered.
Yeah.
If you went back to 10 years, 20, 30, yeah. 40 years. You saw the magazines, and they sold these license plate covers. Oh, get it. Yeah. And now it's a scam. They're dark. You could be 10 feet away.
Yeah.
You can't read you can eliminate this in 1 month. All police departments in the state, along with the state troopers, just simply need to enforce the law, which is on the books, and I believe was revisited about 3, 4, 5 years ago. That is, you cannot, per state law, cover your license plate in the state of Connecticut. You can't have a glass thing over it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, even the frames that you get from the dealer that everybody drives around with, or I went to Notre Dame, if they cover even a portion of the letter, they're illegal. Now, take those license plate covers that are simply a scam to avoid Easy Pass.
Sure.
Or the cops know who it was.
Yeah.
If a cop just if every police department simply pulled over everybody, pulled them into the right, like decades ago when I was in high school, the cop said, you got to take that off right now, or I'm writing your ticket, or we're going to have your car towed. You'd end this problem of these license plate covers in about 3 weeks, okay?
Yeah.
It's very simple. Pull them over, everyone. And you know what? The next cop I see in town, I'm just going to say, hey, why aren't we doing that in Fairfield? Why don't we just pull over everybody?
And I'll tell you why, Rich. And, Rich, I do have to run, but I get the point. I'll tell you why, Rich. This is my honest opinion. Now, I could be wrong here. This is just me. My guess is, Rich, and I'm 100% with you, my friend, on this. If you did that, you'd start to get rumblings from the General Assembly. Hey, a lot of these cars getting pulled over with these plate covers. Yeah, what's the problem? Well, you know. No, I don't know. Tell me. Well, most of these cars are black drivers and Hispanic drivers. Well, yeah, don't they have to follow the law? Yeah, but, you know, we're getting heat from the General Assembly. Oh, don't think that wouldn't eventually happen, Rich, if we went through with your idea, which I am 100% in favor of. All right, guess what? There's more funny business with your electric bills? Maybe. You tell me. Ryan Fazio joins us, Republican State Senate member from Greenwich. Always good to have Ryan by, in particular when it comes to energy issues, and this one has to do with EVs and maybe a hidden tax. Ryan, good afternoon, my friend. How are you?
Good to be back with you, Paul. How are you?
Not too bad, but what is this I see? Big glaring, big headline, Ryan, in the Connecticut News Junkie. Republicans slam EV charging plan as a hidden tax, but advocates say it's a lifeline for overburdened communities. Wow, talk about two extremes there. Ryan, explain what this is to my listeners here, because here we go with EVs again. So what's up here?
So Pura just finalized a program that will provide subsidies, finance through everyone's electric bill for commercial electric vehicle charging and other infrastructure related to commercial electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
So the public benefits section of your bill, which everyone's familiar with at this point, it funds over 50 different government programs related to environment, energy, and social programs.
Okay.
Well, you're about to get another one. There will be, in that section of your bill, we will be financing millions of dollars to install private electric vehicle charging infrastructure for commercial vehicle fleet. So think school buses that are electric for those companies and so on. So it's yet another program that we're paying for through our public benefits, which are already so high that we have the third highest electric rates in the country. Now, this is something that I've tried to stop and other Republicans have tried to stop legislatively. And we had some very, very minor success. We were able to significantly cut the residential electric vehicle charging subsidies in legislation this year that we co-authored. We also tried to kill the commercial subsidies as well, but we were not able to get Democratic buy-in on that. And that's why this is about to go into effect, and we'll have a few million dollars more of public benefits charges that we're all paying in our electric bill.
Now, Ryan, you talk about these are commercial businesses or municipal fleets. You mentioned school buses, and I know there are a lot of electric school buses, and there are, you know, you mentioned a delivery fleet. So the money will go to what? If a fleet owner or a municipality says, hey, I could use 5 charging stations here, is that, even though we're a municipality or a for-profit company, ostensibly, say, a delivery company or whatever, that's public money that's going to go here, is what you're saying?
Yes, basically, they have to sign on to the electric vehicle charging program that's authorized by PURA. And to give the devil's advocate here, PURA thinks that their EV charging program is better for the electric grid because it will dial back usage or charging during peak hours, for instance. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 4 to 8 p.m. people, like right now, are using the most electricity statewide and region wide. This PURA believes that, and some of my Democratic colleagues believe that having a program where the state or PURA or the program's design calls for reducing usage during peak hours is worthy of a subsidy to incentivize those commercial entities to adopt their EV charging infrastructure compared to anyone else's on the market. So that's what's happening here. But in my mind, it's still millions of dollars of private subsidies paid for by individual customers and residents of the state of Connecticut who are already paying so much that I think it's unreasonable.
Yeah, and finally, Ryan, on this whole thing, didn't you guys at least guys and gals in the GOP caucus at least initiate, I should say, the discussion of maybe eventually putting all these public benefits and ideas and charges, which we all know, and you just said, you know, we can play devil's advocate on some of this. Shouldn't these just be budgetary line items? What am I missing here?
I think that's exactly right. 2.5 years ago, I stood at a podium when I became the ranking member of the Energy Committee, and I offered a proposal to eliminate the public benefits charges in our electric bills. Back then, no one even knew what public benefits charges were until the next year when I passed a law that required
what you started? It's all your fault, Ryan. It's all your fault.
We put sunlight on it, and I believe transparency and sunlight are the best disinfectant. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're actually able to muster the public support to cut these things, and the public's on our side. But, to your point, we think that these are discretionary programs. These do not necessarily keep our electric grid going and deliver electricity to your home or to your business. These are discretionary programs, and discretionary programs are funded through the budget, including things like K-12 education, highways, bridges, roads, public safety, and health care. Those are all funded through the normal budgetary process. And there are checks, and there are public hearings, and there is debate, and that's how this should be funded as well. There's no way you could tell me that subsidies for private electric vehicle charging deserves preferential funding to health care for people who need it, or K-12 education. Yet that's what we're doing in the state. It doesn't make sense.
All right, Ryan Fazio. Ryan, thank you for the late afternoon appearance. Appreciate it, my friend. Take care.
Anytime, Paul.
All right, there you go. Hey, joining us right now, a gentleman that's a regular fixture here on the radio station, criminal justice lecturer at the University of New Haven. He's a former supervisory Secret Service agent. There's a new report out, came out over the weekend, more details regarding what some people are saying are errors and misjudgments made by the Secret Service. This all connected to the assassination attempt targeting then-candidate President Trump a year ago in Butler, PA. We all remember, I guess, where we were when we heard about that. I was at a pool party, actually, with a buddy of mine and his wife in Brantford, and all of a sudden, my phone starts to blow up, and I go inside, and we all watch that going, oh, my. Bobby McDonald back with us. Bobby, it's Paul. Good afternoon, sir. How have you been? Hi, Bobby.
Hey, Paul, always great to be back with you. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, sir. Well, it's been a year, Bobby. Obviously, you heard about it over the weekend, and this new report is out, and of course, people talking about the things that the report found. So, as somebody retired from the service, you spent a long time there. You were very frank with us, I remember, when this happened about a year ago and along the way. So, give us your thoughts on this. What do you think?
Well, I think the service has moved a little bit in a proper direction with some purging of leadership at the top, I think, that needed to go after some less than stellar performances, both by Director Kim Cheadle and Acting Director Ron Rowe. They've moved on. President Trump has placed in Sean Curran, who was with him on the dais that fateful day a year ago. I'm still a little concerned. You know, you saw the news about the six agents that were suspended. It's a slow process. The government works at a dinosaur's pace. I think there's still some optics here that I think a lot of people are a little bit concerned about, whether nobody really was held accountable for this situation. Some things have changed for the better. I think supervision has gotten a little better. They've gotten some new assets, some new mobile command posts and drones and things. Assets are nice, but it's the people of the service that have to be able to utilize those assets and utilize them properly to make sure that they're putting together a very robust protective plan for our protectees.
Bobby, explain something to me. Over the weekend, digesting a lot of national stuff, reading as much as I could on this, I heard a term called siloing, I think it was, because there was a basically, and I think one of the startling things I saw everybody picking up on, Bobby, on social media was, hey, they knew something might have been funky 10 days out is what we're told, what this report says, yet that information, for whatever reason, was not spread as widely as people thought of. What is siloing, and is there a fear, Bobby, of maybe burning sources if you let too many people know what you know?
Well, the term siloing, Paul, got legs during 9/11 when it was determined that agencies weren't talking with each other and passing important intelligence information between agencies. We have come a long way in the 24 years since then, and siloing is supposed to go away. But when you see or hear the situation that we heard over the weekend, that 10 days out there was some intelligence indicating, some information that was going to be allowing for nefarious activity. Mm-hmm. Information and intelligence is nice, but if it isn't gotten to the consumer or the customer of that intelligence, who can use the intelligence then to make very good decisions for what they need to do, it really doesn't do us any good. So siloing was supposed to have gone away. There's obviously still some issues out there, and we've got to figure out how to rectify those.
And, Bobby, you know, listen, I understand the grave responsibilities that you guys and gals had and do have in the Secret Service, but correct me if I'm wrong here, please, but is this because of some of the stuff that we hear, not necessarily in the Secret Service, but we hear in the FBI all the way down to local police, is that it's a workplace like anything else, and are there territories that people don't want to get stepped on, and sometimes you're flexing a little bit with, hey, I've been here for X amount of years. Are those challenges the same as in the Secret Service as they might be in, you know, a law firm or something like that that we could better relate to?
Well, a Secret Service in a lot of ways is just like any pharmaceutical company or any other federal agency. There's politics, but we have to get over those things. Mm-hmm. The Secret Service can't do what it does without liaison and working with various state, local, and federal partners. Hey, look, we didn't do a good job on July 13th, but one thing that we've always done well is been liaising with local and state federal partners. You know, when a counterfeit bill is detected in the state of Connecticut at 2 o'clock in the morning, the Secret Service will respond to that. And the reason we respond to that is so that the local police or the state police that are handling it know that we're interested in helping them with that type of nefarious activity, but knowing that we're also going to want to get to know them for when one of our protectees comes to the state of Connecticut or wherever. So we've always been very good at that, and we need to make sure that we continue to cultivate those relationships, but also making sure that all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed in our protective advances. That's very, very, very important.
It sounded, Bobby McDonald, from the sound bites I've heard of the president over the weekend, that he was very careful not to cast aspersions, in fact, praising that sniper who basically took out the gunman with one shot there. So he certainly minded his words over the weekend, I'm sure, out of a sense of thankfulness to the agents that did hustle him off the stage that day.
Right. And I do think the president has noted that, a number of things went wrong that day. And I think that he has tasked Director Curran and Deputy Director Quinn with going in there and fixing those problems so that this doesn't happen again. You know, we need to learn from our mistakes. We also need to learn from all of the different things that have happened over the years. As I think I've said to you before, mm-hmm. all the things that the Secret Service does are built on the Kennedy assassination attempt, the Ford attempts, the Reagan attempts, yeah. and now the Trump attempts. So all of those things are building blocks, and we have to be perfect every day and then get better.
Bobby McDonald, former supervisory Secret Service agent, currently a criminal justice lecturer at the University of New Haven. Bobby, always good to chat with you. Be good, my friend. We'll talk down the road. Thank you.
Talk to you soon. Take care.
All right. Thank you, Bobby. Bobby McDonald, criminal justice lecturer, long time at the University of New Haven, and a former supervisory Secret Service agent. A lot of people voicing their opinions on now what seems to be kind of an about face at the White House, Mr. Trump and his staff saying suddenly, hey, maybe this Putin guy in Russia cannot be trusted. Joining us right now with this kind of whiplash 180 description that people are talking about here from this story, Olivia Rinaldi, CBS News. Olivia, good afternoon. Great to have you with us. So quite a 180, would people say, Olivia? What are they saying around there regarding Mr. Trump's statements now and threats?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, today is definitely one we should mark down on the timeline of Trump shifting policy stances, because this about face on Ukraine is quite notable. Not only today did the president say he'd be sending more weapons overseas to NATO, who then he hopes will decide to pass them on to Ukraine, but he also said he plans on announcing new tariffs on Russia if they don't come to the negotiating table with Ukraine by September 1st. I mean, Paul, this is a big, big change from the president, who during his campaign consistently said that there would be no more weapons to Ukraine, yeah. and he can end this war very quickly.
So do you think, Olivia, this will be seen as maybe a capitulation here to, you know, what people in his camp would call the rhinos or the mainstream Republicans? Because I'm sure this is not playing well with his MAGA base here.
Well, he's going about it in an interesting way that kind of lets him save face here at home, because the weapons are not going directly to Ukraine. Essentially, what was announced today at the White House between Trump and NATO Secretary General Rutte was a deal where the U.S. would be manufacturing and sending weapons to NATO allies, who in turn would pay for them and then send them to Ukraine. Mm. So there would be a middleman. It's not a direct pipeline of aid to Ukraine, but it will be going to NATO, and the expectation is that the European allies in NATO are the ones who, one, are going to pay the U.S., and two, take on the burden of then transferring them into Ukraine.
Interesting. Olivia Rinaldi, CBS News. Olivia, thank you as always for your time. We appreciate it. Take care.
Thank you. Take care. Thank you.
Olivia Rinaldi, you hear her on the radio side here, and you see her on the CBS Evening News. Yeah.